Hi, I'm Femi Okeh. Today on the stream, three stories in the headlines from around the world. In the United States, the January the 6th hearings are underway, but can the in-depth investigation of the attack on the US Capitol influence public opinion? And in Nepal, a former child actor and model went public with her story of rape and sparked a movement to overhaul the country's antiquated sexual assault law. But first, to the war in Ukraine as it enters its fourth month.
The war in Ukraine is not over, so it makes it very complex to see what will be the final outcome of this humanitarian catastrophe, which is very urban, making it even more complex to identify those in need and provide humanitarian assistance, as we would traditionally do in other countries. We're still noticing a lot of internally displaced seeking temporary, medium to long-term housing, having lost everything and unable to secure their winter, basically the very harsh winter season that starts as soon as October this year. We're looking at disrupted school year, disrupted health care, while CORIS is covering the basic needs of the eastern and southern parts of the country when it comes to providing mobile medical services, as well as covering the needs for food and temporary shelter. It is a very complex environment that also looks at disrupted agriculture, overall economy, and the impact on the population that will be very hard to sustain.
With us now is Al Jazeera's Charles Stratford from Kyiv. Charles, you have been in and out of Ukraine telling us the story of the war as it unfolds. What are the differences that you're seeing each time you go back, each time you do another story?
I think the main difference, certainly this time, and bear in mind that we haven't been east yet, we're hoping to go in the next couple of days, is just still this immense sense of shock that this has happened to the people that are bearing the main brunt of it, which are in the east of the country. We were at an IDP, an internally displaced people's center, today in Mariupol, in Kyiv, people who had fled Mariupol, speaking to people there. Yes, as I say, just still unable to really come to terms with exactly what had happened. People who describe the bloodshed, having lost loved ones and family members, some unable to still locate family members, lost in the panic in leaving that besieged city. Interestingly, also speaking to a psychiatrist there who has been dealing with some of the most traumatized of these people, she said something that was very telling indeed, and something that I don't think we really talk about that often, which is this complete kind of disjunct or disconnect between people in Russia with relatives in the east of Ukraine. This psychiatrist saying that she had been displaced in 2015 during the fight between separatists and Ukrainian forces in Donetsk. She had moved to Mariupol. And in the beginning days after the invasion, was in contact with her relatives in Russia. And these were her words. She said that they were telling her not to panic because, in their words, the Russian forces were coming to liberate them.
Oh,
I mean, it's this incredible disconnect. Sense that complete disconnect.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I say, I mean, just one of many stories, thousands of stories that you hear
Charles,
in covering this conflict.
If I may, on Instagram, there's another story that really hits home to me about what war means for Ukrainians. So here you say you visited this Russian Orthodox church in Ukraine in February, just before Putin's invasion. Was utterly exquisite. The front line has encroached closer and closer since then. Just going to click through it. And then that final picture is just stunning. What are we seeing here?
Well, this is part of a Russian Orthodox church complex in a town called Svetohirsk, 17th century Russian Orthodox church complex. Absolutely beautiful, situated on this river. And that wooden church, I suppose, is located about 4 or 5 kilometres to the north of it. And as you see in those photographs, we visited it in January, in the days, weeks just before the invasion. And it was spellbindingly beautiful, something out of a Dostoevsky novel, if you like. And so we were very shocked to obviously have seen it having been hit by shelling, an indication that you know, nothing is unsafe, no matter the historical significance of it. According to the Ukrainian president, over 100 churches have been hit in this war so far. And what's worrying is certainly in the last 3 or 4 days, we are seeing an increasing intensive bombardment of the last two cities in the Lugansk region, one of the two breakaway republics, Donetsk being the other one. And we are getting reports now of what, according to Ukrainian sources, could be at least 10,000 civilians trapped in the city of Severodonetsk.
You got this information, Charles, from a deputy commander who you spoke to just a few
hours ago.
So would you explain to our audience how you do that? How do you be in Kyiv and then still make sure that you're covering the story well?
Well, we're very lucky. We have a network of very good fixers and local journalists that we use. And we've been using, frankly, since the last 8 years, since this conflict really started, obviously 2014, 2015. So we are very well set up as a network. And this is a deputy commander that we're in contact with inside Severodonetsk, who has been stationed there for, we understand, a few months. And, describing a very worrying situation, as I say, for around 10,000 people still there. What's important to recognize, though, Femi, is that these 10,000 people, it's impossible to verify as to whether they actually want to leave. We try and bring in all voices, obviously, as we cover this conflict. And one must recognize that there are a lot of people in that area, in that region, that were very sympathetic to Russia's aspirations, people who associate with Russian culture and Russian language. So it's difficult to be able to gauge as to how many of those estimated 10,000 people are unable to get out because of the severity of the fighting or literally are unwilling to get out. But a very worrying situation, especially in and around a chemical plant, the Azov chemical plant in that town, where we understand around 500 people, including at least 40 children, could well be sheltering.
All right, Charles Stratford. I'm just going to show Charles some of the most recent reporting, which has been at a grain silo in Ukraine. It's here on my laptop, which gives us an idea the ripple impact of a war in Ukraine, where when we started covering this 4 months ago, we were not necessarily thinking of doing agricultural reporting at the same time because of the lack of wheat and grain from Ukraine and Russia that is able to get out into the world. You can follow Charles's extensive reporting on the war in Ukraine by going to aljazeera.com. Charles, thank you so much. Our next story is about rape, and I want to give you a moment so that you have a chance to walk away from the screen if you need to. In Nepal, activists are calling for swift justice for victims of sexual violence.
The current provision is grossly restrictive and unmindful of the state of survivors and victims of sexual and gender-based violence, and it does not factor in the stigma and the trauma that they go through. The Nepal government should consider amending the provision of a 1-year statute of limitation for a period of time that is sufficient and proportionate with the gravity of the offence. This is also a real opportunity for Nepal government to revisit its rape laws and look at them holistically and bring them in line with the international human rights standards, especially ensuring gender-neutral references in the law.
In a series of TikTok posts, a now 24-year-old model and actor says that she was attacked 8 years ago by a beauty contest organizer who also took photos and videos of her and then went on to blackmail her. Now, this has sparked a widespread conversation on sexual violence in Nepal. Joining us from Kathmandu, Deshan Lama is a human rights lawyer at the Forum for Women, Law and Development. Deshan, this is a really disturbing story, but it's not an unusual one for Nepal. What is unusual is that the young woman has come out and told her story. But the story goes back to 2014. Could you briefly tell us what happened?
So, thank you, Penny. In this case, first of all, it's a unique case because, as you said, that this case was the survivor herself came out through a social media. She was viewed by millions of people, youths, human rights activists, lawyers, and so many people, like layperson. So she was herself who was defining all the horrendous thing that happened to her, the torture, rape, sexual abuse for a longer period of time, like more than, like for 6 months, continuous 6 months, she was abused. So she was the one who was telling the stories from her own mouth. So this is a unique case in the history of Nepal, and this is definitely a landmark case that would definitely change the, you know, the laws of sexual violence. It would cover the loopholes of the sexual violence laws in Nepal.
So Deshan, we are looking right now at some of these TikTok revelations from Sushmita, and I don't understand everything that she's saying. Obviously, she's not speaking English and all of these. Can you explain the impact that her looking at the camera, telling her story, what that had in Nepal? What did people do when they saw this?
So when people saw this video, when it came, when it went viral, like, so all the people were very shocked because, you know, she was defining like I said, she was defining all the, you know, the horrifying thing that happened to her, like the continuous torture, rape, and she was psychologically broken. She was frustrated, you know. She kept quiet for all these long years, for 8 years, and she tried all the things. She went to psychologists, psychiatrists, counselor, and, you know, the most important thing is, like, she was not aware of the one-year time limitation, statute of limitation. Mm-hmm. So in the next videos, like, she took help from all the high-profile people, but, you know, very unfortunate that she couldn't be helped or she
right.
couldn't...
Let me just recap for our audience who are outside of Nepal so they understand. If you do not report or file your rape case within 1 year of that attack happening, it's too late. Is that the case, Deshan? So it doesn't matter at what point after 12 months, it's too late.
Yeah,
her
right,
case
right.
won't be taken in the court.
Yeah, right. So as per the, you know, the National Criminal Code of Nepal, the statute of limitation to file the rape case is like 1 year. So if
right.
the limitation is crossed, then unfortunately the case wouldn't be taken. But in this case, you know, all the human rights activists, lawyers, you know, parliamentarians, they really supported, like, all the people took in the street to protest and in the parliament. Right after the incident went viral in the parliament, the lawmakers, you know, registered the motion to, you know...
What are the protesters asking for? What do they want to happen?
The protesters are basically asking for the justice to, you know, remove the time limitation of that has been addressed in the sexual violence law. So basically they're asking for justice, for the safe environment for the women to walk, you know, irrespective of anything, like, to be safe. So they just want the justice for the survivors.
Is that possible for the law to be changed? Obviously, any law can be changed. But the pressure of the mm-hmm. protesters, the story that came out on social media of this horrendous rape, and also the alleged rapist has other mm-hmm. allegations against him. So that is really mm-hmm. serious as well. It means that the perpetrators may well go unpunished. What is realistic that may well happen that changes sexual violence law in Nepal?
Definitely, Penny. Definitely, the law. We are very hopeful that this time the law would be changed, because I'm not saying that all the previous cases were insignificant, but, you know, this time, like, already the bill has been, you know, registered in the parliament. So the parliamentarians are very serious about, you know, extending the time limitation. They are themselves demanding to, you know, extend the time limitation or remove the time limitation. So definitely, the writ petition has been already filed to extend the time limitation. Six female lawyers filed the writ petition to, you know, extend the statute of limitation. So definitely, it will definitely change the bring a very historic change in the sexual violence laws of Nepal. Considering the responses from everyone in the, you know, whether it be like social networking side, whether it be the youths, whether it be the lawmakers, everyone, like, they are coming together.
So the rallying cry,
in solidarity.
The rallying cry is justice for Sushmita. We need justice. Me too. So many ways that the protesters are saying you need to pay attention to us. What has happened to Sushmita? Where is she right now? And how has she reacted to the impact that she has made?
So also keeping in confidential, keeping the her status of mind in confidentiality. So actually, Forum for Women and Law, Forum for Law and Development (FWLD) assisted her to file the FIR in the police. So initially, the FIR had been already FIR was filed. Mm-hmm. It was filed under the Human Trafficking and Transportation Control Act because, considering the fact that the statute of limitation has been already crossed. But then in this case, the government attorney has, you know, requested the lawyers, our lawyers, to also address the charge of rape in the charge sheet. So we are very hopeful because we are getting a lot of support from everyone. So
thank you,
she's
Jasmine. We're going to leave it on that hopeful note. Thank you, because there's so much more mm-hmm. to say. We will be following the story, so hopefully that you will come back to us as it develops. We really appreciate you being on the stream today. And now to the United States, where the January the 6th committee looking into the attack on the US Capitol in 2021 have started public hearings. The actions of former President Donald Trump have been scrutinized by a 9-member panel, and they have been tasked with investigating the deadly riots.
We need to remember that thousands of people, pro-Trump supporters, stormed the U.S. Capitol in a way that we have not seen in recent history when it comes to domestic terrorism. Over 850 people who participated in that have been charged. Over 140 police officers were injured, and people ended up dying as a result of that. People are focusing on whether or not people will actually be held accountable at the upper echelons of our government, and also thinking about other political actors who played a role in this process, particularly when it comes to conspiracy charges. We know what happened. The question is going to be, will white supremacy actually be on trial and be held accountable in a way that we rarely see in the United States of America?
Joining us now, Heidi Zhu Castro, covering these hearings for Al Jazeera. Thanks for joining us, Heidi. I know you've been doing live hits all the way through the day. I was watching early on this morning, and it appeared to me to be an apology tour by the Trump administration. So some of the things that were happening behind the scenes, and we were watching the news thinking, that is really strange. Why would President Trump say that? And then we get to hear all of the things that were happening behind the scenes, and some very bizarre things were happening, Heidi, right?
Absolutely. But, you know, if this was an apology tour, Femi, it's the kind where your mom grabs you by your ear and yanks it and says, you have to say you're sorry. Because I will say, this compelling footage we've seen of the behind the closed door testimony, that's happening because those witnesses are under order legally to, they swore their oath to answer these investigators' questions. So it's not an apology tour so much so as a reckoning.
To. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Interesting.
Right.
Out of what you've heard today, what struck you? Rudy Giuliani was drunk giving advice to the president. That stood out for me, but then that made so much more sense as to his behavior for much of the rest of the time during the time that he was advising former President Trump. Thoughts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was being that fly on the wall, right? Even though these are like conversations about what had happened, but just pretend that you were there within the White House residence. And it was described in vivid detail, kind of the sensation of being among Trump's closest advisors and his daughter, who just had their hearts sinking as the returns were coming in on election night, especially when Fox News, you know, called the race in the state of Arizona, the key swing state for Biden, for the challenger, and how everyone just were disappointed. But they said when they went to Trump, he was livid that he had lost Arizona. He would not accept that. And he would only turn to his apparently, according to witnesses, his inebriated attorney, his private attorney, Rudy Giuliani, who said to everyone, you know, he has to go out there in public and just say that he won, even though, you know, evidence would show otherwise.
So we're getting the behind-the-scenes drama, which is fascinating. This is the inner circle of President Trump. I am wondering who is being appealed to here. Republicans, Democrats, the whole of America. What are your thoughts there?
Well, this committee is certainly hoping to appeal to all of America, and I'm sure their wish list is to speak to the Republican voters, but that is a tall order because, as we know, the opinions about what happened on January 6th and who is responsible has been so baked in among the greater American population for this year and a half that I would say very few people who already think Trump, you know, should not be blamed for January 6th, I don't believe their minds would be changed. And almost everyone you ask would say the same. But it is interesting. You can argue people are overall interested, though, Femi, because we know 20 million Americans tuned in to the opening hearing last week. That is a pretty high number. I mean, it's like Sunday night football, which is really big here in the U.S.
That's huge. Just got here. U.S. TV audience for January the 6th hearing reaches 20 million. So that's a pretty big audience. I am also thinking about there are moments that have been really fascinating for an audience. If you are a President Trump fan, it probably makes you feel like, okay, he was in charge. It was all down to President Trump's decision. And if you weren't a President Trump fan, it basically confirms the idea that he probably wasn't fit to be a president in the first place. What are you hearing from, are we hearing from Republicans watching their own give testimony?
I think many Republican leaders are trying to just pivot away from all of this. When asked, they normally shift the conversation deftly to Biden and how they say he's not, you know, taking care of inflation, for instance, because all are aware here, and this gets to your question about the greater purpose and who they're talking to. There's an upcoming midterm election where the congressional majority is at stake here in Washington in November, and Republicans are hoping that this set of hearings, which are certainly creating huge headlines, does not invigorate the Democratic base, which is, of course, what Democrats want. So it's everything has to be viewed through this partisan lens. And of course, although the committee here would not say that political motivation has anything to do with it, reality is there's an election coming up and everyone wants to play to their voters' favor with this.
Do we know, Heidi, what is coming up next? Do you have a program of events or program of speakers so you know who's coming up so you can watch for, oh, that might be interesting, I'll watch that particular person at the hearing? Is that possible? Does the public and do journalists understand what the next part of the hearing will be?
Yeah, we're getting drips of it. We get a little knowledge like the day before, for example, when who the witnesses are. But bigger picture, the committee here has laid out Trump. They say evidence will show that he had a 7-part plan in lying about the outcome of the election, trying to get it overturned, and then assembling the mob and trying to reap the benefits. So we've seen them go. Yes, last week's was kind of the opening argument. Today was focused on the beginning, the election night loss. And going forward, there's two more hearings this week, and we've been told that they will focus on Trump's attempt to, in the committee's words, corrupt the Justice Department, and when he failed to do so, how he assembled the mob, which they say had the intent of an attempted coup in trying to keep Trump in power, essentially, by force. So very strong arguments, and they've laid it out in a very systematic manner over the course of these half dozen or so hearings.
Heidi, thank you so much. We will continue to watch you reporting live from Washington, D.C., giving us the latest on the hearings and all of the developments. You can find them also on AlJazeera.com. Now, if there is a story that you want us to cover, it's really easy to get to us. We are at AJStream on Twitter. That's AJStream on Twitter. Thank you to Charles, to Deshen, and to Heidi for being our guests on today's show. I will see you next time. Take care, everybody.